Greetings, my name is Shift, and I want to talk about Exalted 2E Combat. I have no idea how many of these podcasts or journals I'll do. I hope to have guest hosts at some point, but this first one at least is going to just be me talking to you all. I hope you enjoy. Today I want to talk about movement rules and why they matter. Now, lots of different games track movement in different ways. D&D does it with grid spaces, there are many games that use hex grids, Warhammer 40k and similar use inches measured from the actual tabletop models, and Exalted uses real-world measurements in the imaginary play space without a map. This lack of map is interesting because I believe, and cannot prove this sadly, that it's almost an outgrowth of the original White Wolf design of being anti-D&D, which was a grid-spaced war game with the dungeon crawl element. So for World of Darkness specifically, and the Storyteller system, the first few editions of it, the use of yard measurements and mental distances as opposed to concrete visual distance with a map meant that combat and action sequences were less about absolute positioning challenges and more about evaluating the scene and creating the story. Now, there could be any number of reasons why there was no map produced for Exalted, any edition, or even World of Darkness. Maybe it was cost, because printing a map cost money, and Wolf couldn't do that. Who knows? So for Exalted, distance or relative range, the space between two or more actors, is one of the more common and important filters on applicability. The other being things like, can you see the target? Is there an obstruction between you and them? Things like that. Now, what I mean by common is that in standard practice of gameplay, you really won't see night scenes or foggy scenes, even though you should. This is mostly just because people don't take the time to think of these things and plan their sessions accordingly. Exalted as a game and the 2E core book go out of their way to really try to sell to you that these scenes you do combat in, or even just action sequences, should happen with sufficiently dramatic backdrop, essentially, which has consequences for how the actual combat should play out. I'm going to get into set pieces a bit later, but from right now we're just going to leave that as is. One fundamental distinction about Exalted 2E is that it does demand you track each tick, even when it's not an acting tick with someone's actual, like, refresh DV action falling upon it. So this means that on paper, the battle wheel isn't ticked forward per action, and literally for years I have done exactly that to my detriment. It is instead ticked forward one tick at a time, addressing everyone's reflexive actions during that tick as well as their actual live big actions. This is one of the nomenclature problems that 2E has had a problem with for a long time. So in reality, what combat movement actually is supposed to look like is that, say, you're on tick zero, you've joined battle, the first actor gets to spend their full reflexive move action as far as they want to go in any direction they can, and from there, everyone else also gets the exact same reflexive movement, too. You don't just have one turn where nothing happens. Everyone gets to do something, even if it's just moving a few yards. They don't have to, but they can. Now, in practice, that's going to be extremely complicated, and most tables don't actually know how to do this effectively. I know I don't. But it still is a fundamental truth of how the rules actually work. The other factor, the inverse factor, is that sometimes a character will have gathered up enough modifiers and assets and transcendent mechanics that make tracking a fiddly little side thing, like movement rules per tick, completely unreasonable. Like the hypothetical Scourge that can dash, 20 yards per movement tick. By the same token, though, tracking those, at least in part, helps provide vital context for why it's actually important that you can dash 20 yards per tick. And that leads into my point of this entire production, which is that if you ignore a rule and make combat too hand-wavy, you lose the vital texture that makes combat actually more balanced than it is in practice. Note that I say more balanced, not actually balanced, just more balanced. To give you a better idea of what I mean by more balanced if you use more rules and less balanced, is that one of the common experiences of the solar game is the flurry or the magical flurry, in which you are almost always assumed by the storyteller or other players to always be in range, and therefore every single attack always hits. When in reality, the expectation of the game itself at a system level, assuming you use more of its parts, is that the opportunities to even use regular attacks are much less frequent. Specifically, we have to take a step back from movement for a moment and look in terms of action and charm timing. If for any reason you are required to take a non-reflexive action during your acting tick, you cannot use simple or extra action charms. As an example, let's say you have to jump to reach your target. If you take the jump action, that counts as a flurry, you cannot use a simple charm or extra action. A more elaborate example is if, say, you're on unstable ground and must flurry an extra miscellaneous action to stay upright and actually move around. So what this all means is that in a white box game, or one that lacks certain textural mechanics, is that attacks happen more frequently, you get hit more often, you take more damage, and you die more quickly. Now, this isn't necessarily more fun, but it is more accurate. It's worth noting also that all of the rules, were written assuming that you would be sitting at a table facing your other players and storytellers, and there would not be a text interface between you and the game itself. This is very important to understand. The reason why it's important to understand is that the text interface immediately and impressively slows the game down, and in turn makes stunting a longer, more involved experience. Or requesting more information like how far away they are they attacking or defending, any of their traits, the text interface makes that kind of information extremely slow to generate. Anyway, so the thing about movement in the system is that, all things being equal, it is your first line of defense against any sort of really, really impressive attack in melee range. Range attacks, however, like in reality, are extremely deadly because you can be attacked without meaningful defense except for your passive DV. There really isn't a lot in the way of active defenses you can take. That being said, though, because you can reflexive move, you can in fact move towards cover as a reflexive action, which in turn prevents you from being attacked by ranged attackers. Or instead of being attacked per se, because we're talking about applicability versus cover bonus. But even then, a cover bonus is definitely something to sneer at. I suppose the key point is that in an ideal situation, the idea of a movement defense before you get the charms or other weird exceptions and such is that if you can move on every tick, you should be able to move to an advantageous position relative to either other characters, be they allies or enemies, or the environment, like a cover bonus position, like under a table or behind a bar or whatnot. As a good example of what I mean is, like, if you can move out of line of sight, you have immediately removed ranged combat as a challenge or threat to you until you have to get back out again. And the mark of a good storyteller, or at least a well-researched one, is that they've developed the scene to allow for that kind of thing to happen. Now, I'd have to look up the definitions exactly in the core book, but really, it isn't that hard to get total cover to the point where you cannot be attacked, like behind a boulder or a wagon or any number of obstructions. And part of the point of stunting as a mechanic is to enable these sort of things to exist logically without the storyteller just demanding the storyteller actually make them exist. Yeah, having brought core book right now, 90% cover, which is the best cover you can get short of being out of sight completely, is everything but your eyes protected, so you can still be shot, you know, through the little, like, arrow slit or this hole in the shield, but it gives you +2 melee cover and +4 ranged cover, and that is nothing to sneer at. By the same token, though, if you are behind a boulder and you can't see your enemy cannot see you, barring magic. It's sort of that logic you have to keep in mind, and if you don't, you run the risk of, like, combat being very samey and unintuitive. Which somewhat leads to my next point, or I guess another point, because I'm going to ramble a lot, is that a lot of bad combats come down to being too permissive. And this is because combat's hard labor, it's a lot of effort, you want to get it over with, you want to be expediting it, you want it to go faster. And in a lot of ways, it's not meant to go fast at all. It's meant to be actually very, very methodical and very, very, very procedural because Grabowski and Chambers, when they developed the actual game, they wanted a very complex TCG-like interaction. Unfortunately, though, unlike a TCG where, like Magic the Gathering and such, which was a big influence, they didn't have a very tight gameplay loop. They had a very, very convoluted stack of modifiers that resulted in basically a very strong tangle of a game. Now, individually, any number of their small systems actually hold up pretty well in isolation. It's attempting to use them all at once is the problem. Even just using a few, like picking and choosing them as part of a good set piece design, is a challenge. One key point I want to make here before I forget is that I'm not discussing any of these things because Exalted 2E is great design or should be treasured above all else or anything like that. Like I said before, it is something that should be respected and analyzed to understand what it does and where it goes wrong. Because if you refuse to engage with the rules or misunderstand how they interact, you get garbage output. And that garbage output leads to this economy, or ecology, I should say, of regurgitated wisdom and the paranoia combat, which, by the way, I'm not denying exists at all. I know it exists. It's there. I've played it. But regurgitation and echo chambering prevents actual discussion and analysis. Now, if you don't think that's worth the effort, by all means, don't worry about it. But trying to tell someone else to stop, that doesn't help anyone either. A good example of what I mean by analysis and assessment was actually Aleph's discovery of the mundane knockback rules in 2E Core, and how that, by the way they worked, she determined that in basically a larger weapon essentially flurry breaks itself. The actual text of the rules, basically in an abstract here, is that you get thrown back 1 yard for every 3 dice of raw damage, pre-soaked damage. So let's take Inx, for example. She is actually by default strength 3, so even if she throws a punch and manages to get past the DV and hits the target is, by the rules, allowed to, or if not guaranteed, to be thrown back at least 1 yard. And mind you, Inx is very, very much nerd physique, other than being strength 3, to even lift her Grand Eyeclave. But taken into context of what her actual weapon does, which I believe is 12 lethal plus her 3 strength, so she at minimum will hit for 16 raw damage dice, and that's going to be 5 yards of knockback. And remember that she can only move when she's uninjured 2 yards per tick without taking a dash action. So she literally hits someone hard enough that she cannot actually hit them again in the same flurry. Now, I should point out that the rules presented in the book actually talks more about the cinematic view of things versus the consequence of hitting someone with a grand weapon means they get flung backwards. This was not really probably meant as an actual feature of grand weapons. Well, okay, the cinematic part was, but I mean more the idea that they flurry break themselves. Minor addendum, if she had dashed during her attack action, she would have had an extra 6 yards added to her movement rate, so she could have actually kept the flurry up if she was really hitting them hard enough to run them down and hit them again. But only if she hadn't spent all of her movement to even get that close in the first place. This, by the way, is why Scourges, released later in 2E, developed the hit-and-run charm tech they did to exploit the per-tick movement rules and in turn act the way they do. Another important thing about movement rules ties into player psychology, because in my experience, the player doesn't think about moving as a tactical option, because they're more interested in their next turn, their big action, which the game did a very poor job of articulating that was actually a thing you would do. So, it's essentially this idea that if you're not acting, you're tuned out. You aren't paying attention. You're just applauding your teammates as they do something. This is part of the problem with running games via online systems, is that without that expectant, I'm staring at you as you're talking effect, stunts get long and elaborate. So, on the note of a possibly productive thought, is that the next time you run a 2E style combat with the tick system is that you want to really train everyone at the table to agree that there is no such thing as your turn, it's that everyone shows up for every tick. And to streamline things, you want to teach people to think about their movement before the tick call comes out. Now, sadly, in a game of like 5 players, you're going to have 5 people talking at once, so to keep things somewhat restrained, remind them and train them well that there's only so many things they can actually do on an off tick, one of them being move. So you want to get them to think about where they want to go, and give them places to go within the scene, which again comes back to white boxing. Because if nothing else, if all you give the player is an enemy to move towards, they're either going to move towards it until they're in range, or they're going to assume they're in range. Which also reminds me that a huge problem I see happening quite often is that most people assume that a fight scene, or even an action scene, happens or starts with everyone right next to each other, when you could have, you know, your opponent on the other side of a bridge, or across the room with a crowd of people in the way, or any number of things. But just assuming that you're all just going to be in punching distance when you start the fight is a disservice to the mechanics. Plus, it's actually very, very boring. On the other note of expediting combat, be very clear what you want stunted or not. Because, especially for an IRC game, if you want to allow per-tick movement, you want to make sure players understand when and where to stunt their moves. Because if all you're doing is having, say, the Dawn move 5 yards towards the Abyssal, you don't need a stunt for that, especially if it's during the off-tick. Another obvious suggestion to make things more manageable is to make sure everyone has a clear turn order that is somewhat independent of the actual tick order. The main thing is that in Exalted, simultaneous actions, including these off-tick reflexive actions for movement, are all resolved simultaneously. They are declared in a first-come, first-served manner, which leads to the late mover advantage, which 1st edition had a problem with. Now, 2E does have rules to govern simultaneous actions, but I won't go into them too much right now because that's more of a table thing than a advice thing. So a good litmus test, I think, for this is that if you have them do a roll during a reflexive move, they should be able to stunt that. That's fine. And if for whatever reason you need to give them, or they feel they need, an asset in the scene from stunting, let them stunt it in. This is like, oh, hey, I need lily pads to step on to run across the water, that kind of thing. One thing worth considering also is that there is a temptation to stunt everything you can for moat and resource regeneration, so you want to be very careful of what you allow at your table, both for game balance reasons and because every single stunt makes the game go longer. A common house rule is once per DD refresh, or once during an active action and once during a defensive action, but you have to find your own metric for what you want to do there. Note that stunting for dice is fine, it's the resources that people try to keep track of. Specifics aside, the key is brevity, because again, you're going to have everyone saying something each tick. And you may yet have people go, say something like, I'm going to have my guy move towards the target every tick unless I say something else. And as long as you can track that, that's fine. And because move is reflexive, you can use it in response to someone else's action. So, I'm about reaching the 20-minute mark, give or take, on this recording, and the next thing I would like to talk about would be range, but I also want to stop this and let you guys digest it and, you know, not wear out my welcome. So, I will end this recording here, but you shall all enjoy, I hope.